Because you have kind of these types of biological processes are really complicated, and you kind of have this string of interactions going all the way from kind of the genetic level, so the basic DNA, up to kind of the interactions of cells that then over time have to give rise to the different shapes and patterns we see.
Hey, and welcome back to the What the Tech podcast. My name is Christopher, and in this episode, Kelsey and I talk to Adam Runyons, a professor at the University of Calgary. We had a great discussion with him about his research at the intersection between computer science and biology. Let's see what the tech is going on.
Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. I guess we'll start off just by saying, how was your day? What did you get up to?
So my day was pretty good. Right now it's mostly at home, but today just got up and started working on some things for my class coming up this semester, and just overall preparing for the new year.
Awesome, that's exciting. Which classes are you teaching this semester?
So this semester I'm actually teaching a course that's a graduate level course that's closely related to my research area. So the course itself is called Computational Morphodynamics, but really the focus of that area is trying to figure out how we can use computational approaches to help us understand how these different forms and patterns that we see in nature emerge. And so, for instance, like, let's say if you're looking at the limbs of different animals, how do you actually create that limb? And then what causes it to kind of vary between, for instance, like the fins of a fish to something like the hands that we have. And so because you have kind of these types of biological processes are really complicated, and you kind of have this string of interactions going all the way from kind of the genetic level, so the basic DNA, up to kind of the interactions of cells that then over time have to give rise to the different shapes and patterns we see. It's really difficult to try and understand how they work or how they're modified in different environments or by evolution without using computational approaches. And so that's in kind of the broad problem that we get into in the course. And the question is, how can we use computational approaches in order to try and investigate this, right? So of course this type of work becomes really interdisciplinary, where you're working a lot fairly closely with biologists who are looking at how organisms develop, but there's a lot of really fun computational problems that come up in this instance. So how do you actually model the interactions between genes and hormones? How do you kind of model that in some type of spatial way, so that you could have the emergence of a good example would be something like just the stripes that you would see on something like a fish. Like, they often have, you may not have looked at it, but they have sometimes really elaborate kind of spotted or stripe patterns. And there's this question of how you have these kind of chemical processes that are operating at the level of cells that then give rise to these higher level patterns. We go through, the course will cover a bit how you model things like that, but then there's also the question of how do we bring this back to biological reality? And this comes then to being able to take imaging data, sometimes at where biologists will go in with some type of microscope and kind of scan things at a very small scale. So we're talking on the scale of actually microns, right? And the question then is, how can we start to extract information from that? Like a common thing would be that once you've taken kind of a microscopic image, how do you actually extract the surface or shape of the organ? How do you kind of segment out the individual cells? And then how do you track those over time and kind of quantify those changes to see how changes in gene expression, and then you can try and relate that back to your model. And to do that, then you start to get into some fun but kind of complicated things that are related to trying to quantify shape and how shape changes over time. So kind of statistical shape analysis. So that's kind of the broad picture. There's a lot of biology in the background, but there's a lot of fun computer science and math in the foreground. I'm enjoying putting it together.
So I guess you may have just answered that in your statement, but is this a new class? Is this a new course for students to be able to take?
Yeah, so this is the first time it's been offered. It's a graduate course. It's offered as a special topics course. The number for it is 601.1, I think, or 0.10. And yeah, so this is the first time it's been offered. There's been kind of some related courses by other faculty. So of course, Christian Jacob, the department head, has an interest in biological computation, and some of the courses he's offered previously have some similarities. And then Professor Krasinkiewicz has done a lot of work in plant modeling and has offered a number of courses that were focused more on pure modeling aspects. But this is, I think, probably the first time that kind of all these different aspects you need to really kind of go from models to connected in a really direct way to the biology has been offered at the university.
And so just looking at your background, you've done, you know, a BSc of pure and applied math at U of C, a BSc and a master's of computer science at U of C, and your PhD of computer science at U of C. How did you get involved with biology?
So that's an interesting question, because back in high school, I wasn't a great student in high school, so I wasn't involved in too much, but definitely not biology. And I think in part for me, it was that, because when you get into biological systems, they're so complex. A lot of, at least what was taught in high school at that time, was closer to memorization. It didn't feel like functional knowledge, like something that you could take and then use to really directly understand things. And so when I got into university, then I started out in computer science, and then I became really kind of excited as I got into the university mathematics, because it kind of provided such a concise way to express yourself, and this really precise way of expressing ideas, and then programming gave a way to kind of enact it, right? So then I think in my second year, this was the end of my third year of undergraduate, then I was kind of looking around and I saw that one of the profs in the graphics department, which was Dr. Krasinkiewicz, was taking on summer research students. And I took a look at some of the work, and at that point, looking at his work, you could start to see how you could use kind of computer science and mathematics to start to understand how some of these forms were made. And sometimes it turned out to be quite simple. And that was the type of thing that really kind of drew me in, when you could start to take a look, for instance, at the different forms around you and realize that actually some very simple rules could explain those shapes or those patterns, even though they look really complicated and intricate. And so that was kind of what drew me into that. And then I was fortunate enough to work with Prashemek on under one of the summer inserts. And that kind of got me launched. So from that, then I kind of continued in the area. But kind of the fun thing is that, and I think a lot of people, when they look at the work I do, then they think, okay, you must have to have some intense biological background to get into it. But at the end of the day, most of the time you're working on a pretty focused problem. And so you need to pick up a little bit of biology. And that kind of then constrains more the computer science and the mathematics that you apply to it. And so, starting from there, then I kind of got more and more into the biology and started to enjoy that side of it as well.
Very cool. And you mentioned that your work involves looking at the different patterns that are on animals, such as scales on fish or the stripes on zebras. What have you found so far? Is there any commonality between species? Are there any commonalities between, families?
For sure, that's a great question. I think thinking on that has really evolved a lot over the last 20 years or so. And a good question, before I get more into answering your question directly, like kind of a related question is similarities kind of at what level of abstraction? Because if we get down to like the particular proteins or hormones are involved that are involved and how they interact, then in some cases that can be quite conserved. So for instance, if we're looking at the genes and hormones that shape, for instance, the shape of a leaf, right? And if you look between like maple to poplar to most of the crop species that we have, then in that case, it seems like it really is the same major players that are just tweaked in slightly different ways to give all these different leaf forms, right? If we go down and look at something like limbs, then it seems like in order to pattern like the digits in the hand versus the fin in the fish, it's appears at this point that it's really the same mechanism, some of the same genes and proteins that again are kind of tweaked by evolution, right? But if we go to kind of a slightly higher level of abstraction, then we can start to find a lot more commonalities. And if we take a look at something like stripes on fish versus pigment patterns that you might see in other species, or even the way that hairs or pores on your body are kind of positioned, then in that case, it seems to have the same logic and be kind of the same, a similar mechanism, even to the one that positions your digits. Yeah, it's just that in each case, you have kind of different actors playing these similar roles, right? And so in the case of animals, which I'll move on from in a sec, then all of these seem to be governed by something called reaction diffusion, which was actually first discovered and kind of figured out. Yeah, the basis of this was actually figured out by Alan Turing. So kind of we often consider to be one of like the pioneers in computer science. And it comes down to a really basic principle that's kind of local activation and then kind of lateral repression. So the basic idea is that when something starts to become a digit or a hair or a spot in some type of pigment pattern, then locally it really amplifies that transition, but then it kind of tries to shut it down in just a slightly broader region. And what's kind of neat about this is it gives this really simple mechanism that allows you to make spatial patterns. So in that way, you can end up with a really common logic that explains a large number of phenomena. And I think that's how our understanding has been kind of evolving. In my own work, I work mostly with plants. And then in that case, then we have something that also has a bit of the logic of this local activation and lateral inhibition, but it's just implemented in a slightly different way. And in that case, then that basic logic, for instance, is what that basic process, the same process, actually determines where you have leaves or buds on the plant, as well as where once the leaf grows out, it helps to position where all of the kind of protrusions are. So if you think of a maple leaf and all of the lobes on it, these are all actually the same process, just kind of tweaked and operating in slightly different contexts. So I think there appears to be a lot of generality in the logic, but in some cases now we can kind of surprisingly see that even in terms of kind of the key players.
So when you're starting out at kind of, I guess, a more general level, are you then able to kind of predict a shape? Like, do you have like equations or modeling that allow you to kind of start at the beginning from like the proteins or the cells and figure out what it's going to look like afterwards, like a leaf per se, or like a straight pattern?
Yeah, so I would say to some degree, at this point in time, actually moving towards increasingly predictive models is the big challenge that the field is facing. At this point, there's been a lot of building towards, it would be more along the lines of, if we take a look at all of the biological processes that are going on, like even in a single cell, we're not able to model all of those at that point in time. So in each of these cases, if we're looking at just some type of pattern, or if we're looking at how the shape of an organ emerges, then there's been a lot of work in trying to establish what are kind of minimal models that capture the key aspects. And so a lot of the initial work has really focused on, okay, how can we have some model that captures kind of the emergence of a pattern, the emergence of the shape, and then they would try and tie it more to the underlying genes or molecules. And in terms of kind of predictive ability, then it would be trying to reproduce what happens if you were to knock out a gene, which was also the case in my work, where in a lot of cases, we build a basic model, and then we would see, okay, if we knock out this key component, do we take a leaf shape that has a large number of protrusions and make it something really simple, which is what they would see biologically. And so that's where we were going. But now that we start to have a better ability to really, and this has only been really in the last 5 or 6 years, to actually measure growth at the cellular level over time, it's become more of a question of how can we become really predictive? Can we try and figure out what happens if we just slightly increase or decrease expression of this gene in this domain? Can we actually predict that? And moving towards making the whole field much more quantitative and predictive.
Super cool, super interesting. A couple questions. You mentioned, first of all, that you were comparing different patterns, as what I said previously, like scales on fish or stripes on a zebra.
Yep.
How do you go about coding that? What kind of programs are you using? What kind of languages are you using? What are you looking for? How are you breaking down that data?
Sure. And it depends a bit on what particular problem you're trying to solve. In a lot of cases, then if we talk about how you would simulate some of these patterns, then it turns into what we would normally call ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations. And so then we end up using numerical techniques in order to kind of efficiently solve for the evolution of that over time. So in this case, then this really starts to tie the whole field to kind of simulation. And what tends to make things more complex when we're talking about taking a look at how these patterns form is the fact that they don't just form in some static template. It's not like the zebra is born and then it just patterns all the stripes, right? Or quite often, this doesn't happen at one point in time. And in fact, what you're seeing is kind of the result of a pattern that evolved during the entire development. And for something like if you're talking about pigment patterns, then they're kind of more ornamental. So you only care about the end result. But for things like vasculature, then this is something that needs to be functional even as the organism is growing and all the way through. So then you have this problem of trying to kind of pattern a structure that can support the growth of the structure and in this kind of growing domain. And when we're trying to take into account representing and simulating that growth, then we need some types of data structures that dynamically represent the geometry and allow it to be refined over time. And quite often, then when we get into more advanced models, then this means that you actually want to simulate kind of the mechanics of its growth, which can be, of course, then influenced by whatever pattern is happening. Veins are going to have different mechanical properties than the surrounding tissue. So in that case, we end up moving towards more physically based simulations where we could try and do something simple, which turns into just kind of pretending everything is a whole bunch of masses connected to springs, or we can go to more advanced methods. And these would be where we kind of borrow from an extend techniques that they would use, for instance, in engineering applications, which are known as kind of finite element methods, which give a nice passage from some type of continuous material to some type of discrete triangulation or kind of 3D, we would have kind of a whole bunch of tetrahedrons filling this volume, right? And finite element method allows us to take kind of the continuous equations that engineers would use for mechanics, and then kind of apply it over this more discrete domain that we need for simulation. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then my second question is, you mentioned you want to move more into simulation aspect and building those prediction models. Would you be building your own program to do that, or is that an already existing program that you just have to write a script into?
Sure. Yeah. So I would say the vast majority of the work we do, there doesn't exist much in terms of previous libraries. So if we compare it to something like bioinformatics, right? Bioinformatics, a lot of times you go and you might download something like an R script that's special case for what you want to do. And in our case, that typically doesn't exist. We're building a lot of this, the libraries that we're using in C++, and then trying to get some performance advantage by running a lot of things in parallel on the GPU, just so that we can try and speed up simulation times. There have been some special purpose languages for aspects of development over time, but a lot of them have focused either on kind of simplifying everything to 2D, so 2D cellular tissues, kind of a further simplification where you would deal with just one-dimensional or branching structures. And in particular for one-D and branching structures, there's one formalism called L-systems that was really developed for the purposes of modeling plant development, actually here at the U of C by Professor Pashinkiewicz, who's also done a lot of other work in the field, that works quite well. And people were able to get quite far in the cases where you would take a tree and reduce it down to just kind of a segment of kind of a pure tree structure, right? Where you have just a segment of kind of internodes and then branching points. But yeah, when we start moving to these more complex kind of 3D models where we want to simulate mechanics and growth, then there hasn't been much in terms of general purpose languages or software tools that have been published. So you end up doing a lot of it from scratch. But yeah, I've been working with a group for the last 5 or 6 years that were and kind of contributing to work where we're working together to kind of develop something that would start to provide that basis.
And so as someone who enjoys biology as yourself, what do you hope your findings are used for? What do you hope the applications of the programs you're writing are used for?
Okay, so personally, I do this because it's super interesting, right? And that's what got me into it. And I really enjoy some of these fundamental discoveries or just figuring things out. At the same time, looking at kind of the history of my work, I can see that it feeds into a large number of other things. Kind of for me, like I think there's kind of this interesting thing that if you work on a really hard fundamental problem, then you're going to obtain an insight that's going to be somehow broadly useful. And as kind of an example of that, some of the earliest work I did was on modeling just vein patterns in the leaf. And we came up with kind of a high level geometric approach that was really based on this idea that wherever you have enough space, then there'd be some source of a hormone there that would then kind of induce new veins to grow up towards it. And there's some more details. If you look on my webpage, you can see the paper from way back and go through it. But we ended up at a really simple approach that seemed to capture kind of the essence of this. And what was kind of interesting is that in that case, it may seem like kind of a niche problem, but this was something that actually a fair number of people in computer graphics and also biology had tried to do previously and hadn't been able to quite crack it. And so what kind of came from this, once we actually published this result, is we ended up with a fairly simple approach. And it turned out that we could take the same idea, and then by putting it in 3D, we were able to now take these what previously were kind of markers of the substance that elucid, that kind of caused vein formation. In 3D, they just kind of represented available space. And this was enough to actually make pretty plausible tree models and was really kind of a departure from what people have been done previously. And in that case, then that kind of fed into a whole line of work that in computer graphics, where people have been using this for a lot of different tree models. And in fact, kind of a more elaborate model that came from a later paper we developed was implemented, for instance, by Weta Digital and used in the Hobbit trilogy and a number of other major motion pictures. And at this point, if you actually go into, you can find implementations of this kind of basic algorithm, which is called the space polarization algorithm, in a lot of software for major motion pictures. So you can find implementations, for instance, in Maya and a few others. So it's turned into something that's been really broadly used now to model kind of these more organic, either vein patterns or 3D branching structures. Sometimes people tweak it to kind of apply it to, for lightning and things like that. More recently, people have been using it, even though we started in plants, people have been actually adapting the same algorithm to start working in animals and using it in the context of trying to reproduce, for instance, vein patterns in some veins that kind of encase the lungs, or kind of the vein patterns in the leaves of mayflies, or even as a component of, there's a paper actually just came out this year where they use it as a component of an algorithm to try and reconstruct different aspects of kind of how neurons are connected in the brain, where it's one of a larger system. And I think that's kind of one of the most exciting things for me when you do these things, just because it's a really interesting problem that people don't know how to solve. And way back in 2005, when we published the paper, we were just kind of thought, hey, this is fun and cool. But looking back on kind of 15, 16 years later, we can see kind of these threads that come from it that show how if you have kind of more fundamental idea where it can lead to.
That's super interesting. I guess speaking of memorable moments in your research, is there one thing that really stood out to you or surprised you, or something you just really love that you discovered along the way?
Yeah. Oh man. Okay. I have to think back. Because for me, I feel like there's been a lot over the years, but I think some of the big ones have been that moment where I'm working on trying to understand some type of biological pattern or process or something that we see around us. And then it's quite often that moment where you create some type of model and you realize just that there's some simple essence to it, that it can be some key simple feedback that just produces a particular shape or pattern. And so like a more recent example of that that was a lot of fun is we were working on something. We were working on models of how cells actually get their shape in plants. And of course, this isn't something you can see just by eye, but if you take almost any leaf or a lot of the other parts of the plant and put it under a microscope, then quite often you'll see that some shapes just look like simple polygons, but you have these other shapes that look like kind of these curious jigsaw puzzle shapes. So they almost look like pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. And and it had been kind of a longstanding question whether these cells and that kind of that really intricate interlocking shape served any purpose, or whether it was kind of more of an accident or a happenstance or forced by kind of other cells around them. And working with a team during my postdoc, then we were able to kind of reasonably show that actually it seems like what's happening there is that cell shape is mainly to try and reduce kind of the mechanical stress in the cell. Because if they didn't have those interlocking lobes, then you would end up with really big open spaces in the cell. And this comes to, and the reason you have so much stress there is a bit of a quirk of how plant cells work, where in fact they're filled with kind of this water that's under high pressure. So if you end up with kind of a really big open space in the cell, then this pressure is going to just push it out. And in fact, kind of these interlocking lobes that kind of reduce the empty spaces in the cell kind of serve to help stop the front of the cell from really being pushed out and kind of stretched. So kind of a more relatable example might be something for this would be if you think of something or was it like an inflatable mattress? And when you have an inflatable mattress, you almost always have some type of reinforcement in the interior that that form kind of these bars that stop it from really bulging out. And so another, so plants don't want to put these weird reinforcements in the middle of the cell, so they just kind of create these weird indentations that allow it to eliminate these big empty spaces. And it was really fun to kind of work through that problem and figure it out and see that these kind of weird cells, which you can find kind of all over the plant kingdom, might have a very concrete function in trying to reduce the amount of mechanical stress. And I think the really fun part of that was when I was creating the model to kind of reproduce that. And it turns out that really all we need to assume is just that the plant cells are kind of reinforcing themselves wherever there's high stress. And that's really enough in order to take something that would be a polygon and then convert it into these really intricate shapes.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think that was kind of everything we wanted to ask you about your research. Okay. So thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I guess I'll follow up by asking if students are interested in your work or what you do, do you have any opportunities for them to come and work with you on your research, or is there a way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. If students are interested in working with me, either at the undergraduate level on an undergraduate project or an honors thesis, or if you're just wrapping up your degree and you're poking your head up to look around for a master's or a PhD project, right? Then, then absolutely feel free to contact me just via my university email. And yeah, and I'd love to chat with any students who are interested in solving interesting problems.
Very cool. Adam, what is your UCalgary email, just for the listeners?
Okay, yeah. So it's arunions@ucalgary.ca. So, because no one knows how to spell Runyons, so I'll spell that out for you. It's ARUNIONS.
Very cool. Thank you so much for your time, Adam. It was so nice getting to talk to you.
Yeah. Oh, it was a pleasure for me as well.
Hey listener, thanks for tuning into this episode of What the Tech Podcast. Thanks again to Adam for being our guest, and make sure to follow us on Instagram @UofC_CPSC and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast. Have a great rest of your day.